Hello, everybody. Welcome to Behind. Oops, are you all hearing me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because I was afraid I'd. Uh-oh. I was afraid that I would have to. Oh, now I can't get my. It's okay. I won't worry about it. All right. So, welcome, everyone. I'm going to just kind of wait like 10 seconds, and that might make it easier to edit for editing purposes. So, I'm just going to count 10 seconds and we'll start over. Good evening and welcome to Behind Our Eyes book launch for August 7th, 2025. And this evening, we have the pleasure of featuring Linda Wright, the author of My Turn, a memoir. And before I will be interviewing her, but before I do that, I would like to share with you Linda's. The synopsis of Linda's book and her bio. So here's the synopsis. Weaving two different parts of her life, Linda Wright combines the care she received from her parents and the care she gave to them when they became elderly and frail. She was born with a rare bleeding disorder, so even the slightest bump created deep bruises on her body and minor injuries kept her out of school. The disorder limited her ability to grow up like a typical kid, riding bikes, climbing, and running. Despite the many hospitalizations of uncontrolled for uncontrolled bleeding and infusions to clot her blood for a condition that even doctors struggled to treat, Linda's parents gave her a childhood filled with wonder, joy, and love. My parents protected me, inspired me, and believed in me. They were the ones who had taught me how to be safe, Linda said. When her aging and infirm parents grew to need increasing levels of care themselves, she declared, I would do whatever it cost to care for them. It was my turn. About Linda. Born and raised in Springfield, Massachusetts, Linda currently resides in Tallahassee, Florida, with her spouse, Robin Gray. She is a retired librarian, having worked for one school library, four public libraries, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, where she was a consultant for librarians serving in institutions including county jails and state prisons. She was born with a rare genetic bleeding disorder and has been a writing coach and editor for My Girl's Blood, an international organization dedicated to sharing the lives of girls and women with bleeding disorders. Currently, she is one of the administrators of a closed Facebook group that is an online community for people with a Factor I deficiency. She is also a cancer survivor and liver transplant recipient. Her memoir, My Turn, When Caregiving Roles Reverse, was published by Greywood Press in 2017 and is now available as an audiobook. She is a member of Behind Our Eyes, an organization of writers with disabilities, Women Writing for Change, an online community of women writers who are passionate about making a positive change in the world through their words and stories, and Writing for Witness and Resistance. More information about Linda and her writing can be found on her website, Graywood, that's GRAYWOOD press.com. So, Linda, first of all, talk to us about how your book is laid out.
Well, thank you so much for that great introduction. But I would like to give Lisa a chance to talk a little bit about the organization that's sponsoring us tonight. Is that possible, Lisa?
Well, we usually do that at the end, but if
Oh,
you
we
want
do it
Lisa
at
to do
the
it
end.
now, that's
Okay. All
fine.
right. Well, we have some new people here who might want to know, but That's okay.
Well, I'll leave it up to Lisa. Do you want to do it now or do you want to wait till the end?
I can do it anytime. Just let me know when. If you want me to do it
Okay.
now, I'll do it now. If you want me to do it at
Well,
the end, I'll do it at the end.
we could, yeah, I why don't we just do it at the end? And let's just concentrate on Linda. This is Linda's night right now, I think. So, Linda, let's just I know you're trying to stall, and I know that, but it's okay. Just go ahead and be act natural and just tell us about the book and how it's laid out.
Okay. Well, when I laid out the book, I knew that I had several different stories that I wanted to tell. I wanted to talk about my being a child with a very rare genetic disorder. And I wanted to talk about the childhood I had from very loving and protective parents. And then I wanted to also talk about how my parents, when they got older, they needed to be cared for and what it took to do that. So I divided the book into three different sections. The first section, I alternate between stories of my childhood and stories when I was first learning about how my parents' lives had changed now that they were in their mid-80s. And the second section is when my parents actually moved into our home and we cared for them ourselves. And the third part, unfortunately, was when we were not able to continue that care at home. And my mother went to a nursing home, and we were also trying to take care of both of Robin's parents. Now, the sections that were divided in the beginning are very theme-based. So, for example, the first chapter is when I found out for the first time that my parents weren't doing as well as I thought they were and that they needed help. And then the second chapter, which I believe Abby is going to play a bit from, is about the first time my parents discovered that I needed more assistance than they thought I would.
All right, well, let me get the screen share going here and I will play that and then we can go on. Just give me one second here.
You have started screen share. Press Bow Book Launch. File Explorer 2 of 2. Bow Book Launch. File. Linda writes book launch. Participants can now see your screen alert. Speech mode on demand.
All right, here we go.
Do no harm. From my parents, I learned that during the first months of my life in 1949, I seemed like any other child. When I began to crawl and stand, bruises appeared on my pudgy arms and legs. I'm so careful with Linda, but she still has black and blue marks. Aren't you worried? Mom said to Dad. He shrugged and turned to feed me another spoonful of mashed squash. One of the stories my parents told became embedded in my own memory, as if I could actually remember it myself. As a toddler, I loved taking a bath. I played with the floating ivory soap, splashing and giggling. It had a pungent smell and made bubbles as Mom lathered my hair. I wiggled as she scrubbed my back with the washcloth. One evening, in a hurry to get to the bath, I slipped and hit the bridge of my nose on the edge of the porcelain tub. It was something that could happen to any toddler still learning how to walk. By the next morning, a deep blue sac appeared under my tongue. It hurt when I tried to eat or drink. My mother rushed to a neighbor's apartment. Can you take me to the hospital? Something's wrong with Linda. Noises from metal instruments clanked as they dropped onto trays in the emergency room. The unfamiliar smells of disinfectant and isopropyl alcohol filled the air. The bright lights erased all the shadows. The on-call physician bent over me and put his fingers on the pressure points under my chin. He squeezed hard. My mother gasped, "Don't do that. She bruises easily." The man in the white coat glared at her. "Let me do my job, or I'll have you removed from the room," he snarled. He left welts around my tiny neck where his fingers had pressed. Even when he saw what he had done, he didn't apologize for accusing my concerned mother of being a hysterical woman. The doctor ordered a blood transfusion. He stuck a needle into my arm and pulled it out. Then he stuck a needle into my other arm. It's hard to find a vein on a child this young, he said more to himself than as an explanation to my mother. By this time, I was wailing and struggling to get away. The nurse held me down while the doctor took a scalpel and cut a line on my ankle, inserting a tube into the vein so the blood could flow from the glass bottle and into me. "I want to keep her here overnight for observation," he said, removing the IV line and wrapping a bandage over the wounds he had made. Then he admitted me to the pediatric ward. Dad had come to the hospital on the city bus. After he got out of work, he found a note from my mother on the kitchen table explaining where we were. The nurse was trying to put me in a crib with cold, slippery bars. I stood up, raising my arms toward Dad. He shook his head sadly. My mother took the charge nurse aside. "My daughter will climb right out of that crib." "Don't worry, we have many children in cribs. They don't get out," replied the nurse. The lights flickered. Visiting hours ended. My parents looked at each other and then at me. "We have to go now." Dad kissed my fingers.
"I'll be back to get you in the morning," Mom sniffled.
By the time my parents reached the elevator door, they turned to see me tottering as fast as I could behind them. I had climbed to the top of the bars and shimmied down to the polished linoleum floor, running to catch up with Mom and Dad. What my parents did next, I don't know. They didn't say. My parents recalled the details from their different perspectives.
Wow, that is amazing, Linda. I've never known of a child climbing out of a crib. You showed them, didn't you? My goodness.
Thank you, Abby. I was definitely a challenge for my parents.
You were. Wow. I bet that's the first kid they had that crawled out of the crib. Wow. All right. So anyway, hold on. I just lost my place in my file here. All right. So in your book, you talk about the contrast between your parents caring for you as a result of your bleeding disorder and you caring for them. Was there a moment or memory that made you realize it was your turn to give back?
Yeah, when I started visiting them after I had a telephone conversation that sort of alerted to me to the fact that they were not doing as well as I imagined they were. And I talk in the book a little bit about how I had always, after I moved out of my parents' home and they couldn't see me every day, I didn't always tell them when I had to go to the hospital or when I needed a transfusion. I didn't want them to worry about me. It didn't really occur to me that my mother then was doing the same kind of game with me, and that she had had spinal fractures because she had osteoporosis. And I didn't realize she had been unable to get out of bed easily. She was in a lot of pain. She had multiple doctors that she saw. But when I would travel back to Springfield to see them, she would have already propped herself into her rocking chair and she was smiling and happy and doing well. And we'd have a good conversation and I would leave and not be the wiser.
Oh, my gosh.
So it took me a while. But when I realized on the phone that she was kind of hedging and things were not right, I started going more often and staying longer. And when I first dropped by, she was in bed. And I realized how much pain she was in and what she was unable to do. They had, both of my parents had been very healthy, very active people, but now she was 86 and things were beginning to fall apart. And so that's when the light bulb went on. And I thought, I have to take care of them. They can't take care of themselves anymore.
Yeah, wow. So in your book, you mentioned suffering a stroke while caring for your parents. How did that impact your ability to help them?
Yeah, the stroke was like the third thing that happened in a row. The first thing that happened that made caring for them really not as possible as I had hoped it would be, was after, I believe they had been living with me for 3 years at that point, And I actually tripped and landed very hard on one foot and broke an ankle. And it was a bad fracture. And I had to stay in bed for a while with that fracture and wear a boot and not put any weight on that foot. And then after that, I learned that I had hepatitis C and tried medication that was very dangerous and created more problems than it did any good. And the third thing was, right after I stopped taking that medication, I did have a stroke. So there were a lot of things that happened in my world that I didn't want to happen. I didn't expect to happen. I really thought I was going to be able to continue to work and take care of my parents. And after a few years, I simply wasn't able to do either to keep my job or to take care of them. And they did go into an assisted living facility that wasn't far away at all from where I lived, but that's the next chapter of the book is when they need to be on their own.
I see. So you told me that the way you planned to care for your parents didn't go as intended. Tell us about that.
Well, I really did believe that if I could keep them in a home that they were comfortable with, I knew what they liked to eat. I knew what their habits were. I knew that my father really still loved to have a good walk at least 3 times a day. He wanted to go out and walk a mile. I knew that my mother loved children, and so I was able to do things like get some of the neighbors to drop by and visit. And I thought this would be a much better environment for them in their last years of life, and had really counted on being able to do that. So it was heartbreaking and difficult when I realized that my own health issues were going to get in the way of that. And that's not uncommon. I think you understand, Abby, when you're taking care of someone else. People very often have health problems themselves, and caregivers are definitely vulnerable at that point, and I certainly was. So yeah, there's a lot in the book about those things that I went through myself. The hepatitis C diagnosis was a shock in some ways, but in other ways it was not. I remembered very well getting a blood transfusion and feeling unwell, and the doctor being puzzled and saying, "Well, you don't have hepatitis A, you don't have hepatitis B, but you sure do have hepatitis symptoms." And I was only in my 20s at that point. So that was, by this time, it's been 30 years. And now I'm getting diagnosed with hepatitis C.
Oh my gosh.
And so, yeah, that was a big a curve. And my doctor was thinking that I had just contracted hepatitis C, and I had to say to him, "No, I don't think so. I think I've actually had hepatitis C for 30 years." So I began actively looking at what I could do about that. And at that point, this again was a number of years ago. There were very few options, and one of them was a very difficult combination of medications, which was included a medication called ribavirin, and one of the medications you took gave you bad symptoms in one direction, and the other one gave you bad symptoms that were different. My hematologist didn't want me to do those medications at all, and so there's quite a bit in the book about how I fought quite aggressively to be allowed to try those medications because I thought it was my only option. In fact, at that point, they were saying that's your only option. So that was it was difficult to say the least. I completely lost appetite. Odors were just so oppressive. I remember saying to Robin, "Don't wash the floor anymore. I can't stand the smell of the stuff that you wash the floor with."
Oh dear.
So it really, but the worst part of it was that it was lowering my platelet count. And
Ooh.
because I already had a bleeding disorder, the platelets were about all I had to counteract any kind of injury. And my hematologist was just going berserk, saying, "We can't do this, we
Oh.
can't do this, we can't do this." And
Oh.
finally, he just said, "I'm not going to let you do this anymore."
Wow. Interesting. In the book, you mentioned your relationship with your spouse, Robin. How did you two meet, and what role did she play in your parents' care?
Well, Robin and I met when we were undergraduates. We actually lived in the same dormitory at Boston University. And we had become very good friends. And then we both moved back to our parents' homes after we graduated. I found a job as a librarian, but she went to Yale University and got a degree in religious education. From the divinity school there. And after 2 years, we both realized that we wanted more education. I knew that I couldn't advance unless I got a degree in library science, and she knew that what she really wanted was to be a minister and not to be a religious educator. So we had been seeing each other, we'd been having phone conversations. She was in Connecticut. I was in Western Massachusetts. We had occasionally gotten together for a meal or, conversation. And so we decided, well, what the heck? We're both going back to the Boston area. We should live together. And that's how we actually started living together. And that was sometime, I think, about 1973, I believe. So it was quite a while ago.
Oh,
And
interesting.
now we have been together for more than 50 years. So,
Wow.
yeah. So we, of course, over the years realized that we really liked living together, that we really enjoyed each other's company, and that we didn't really want to live with anyone else. So we were married in a Unitarian Universalist church as soon as it was legal to do so. But even before that, we went for what was called a service of holy union in one of the Unitarian Universalist churches. So when we got legally married, we renewed our vows from 15 years before and were legally married. And that's the story.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Very sweet story. All right. So, in your book, you talk about your frustration with the healthcare system during your childhood and adulthood caregiving years. Is there any advice you would give anyone in similar situations?
Oh, I have lots of advice. I guess my first advice is to trust yourself in terms of what you need, which is probably very different than what the next person needs who has probably the same thing you do, but it might be quite different. And to be very clear with whatever healthcare person you're dealing with, is this something you want or something you don't want? And to really stand your ground in that.
And with that would go for, what you need. You'd also want to be clear on what you think your loved ones would need if you're caring for a
That's
loved
right.
one, isn't it?
That's right. And that's where
Right.
you need that support of that loved one, that person who will say, "Yes, you have a right to do this. This is something I will support you." And I often think about
Oh, Linda, I think we lost you. Are you still there? Uh-oh.
No, she
Oh, okay.
is
She
not,
might
yeah,
she
her
must have she
signal
must have
must.
gotten dropped. Oh dear. All right, we'll wait just a minute to see if she comes back.
It looks to me like I'm
Oh,
still.
there she is.
Oh, there she is.
There
Okay.
she is.
It looks to
All
me like I
right.
was I was here, but I can't tell
You've
anyway.
disappeared momentarily. You were talking about advice for those, caring
Yes.
for loved
You know,
ones.
I think you need to say what you really want and need. You need the support of family and loved ones to do that. And you need to be able to talk to doctors about alternatives. To me, there are always some choices. And doctors don't always present it that way. And so to be able to say, okay, you're recommending surgery, but what are my other choices?
Right.
And I think that's very important because the doctor will always give you the first option is the option that he or she can do. So if it's a surgeon, the first option is always going to be surgery, but it
Right.
doesn't mean it's the only option.
Right,
And
right.
it does take my mother, for example, could never do that. She would take whatever the doctor said and just do it. And there's quite a bit in the book about points at which I say to the doctor, "No, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
That's not my choice." So it does take some intestinal fortitude to be able to say, "No, I have some other things that I want to do." And I will take the whatever happens, I will take responsibility for it. Which I think is important. I mean, the doctor is aware that no matter what medication they give, there's going to be a side effect. Whatever other thing that they offer you, there will be pluses and minuses involved. And that conversation is a really important conversation to have.
Absolutely. All right. So now we would like to know, I'm sure, about the audiobook. How did you produce that and where can we find it?
Okay. Well, of course, after I had my stroke, one of the side effects I had was that it's called aphasia. And I was not affected in terms of right side, left side, which some kinds of strokes are, but my problem was speech and reading. And I had been a librarian for years. I still read a lot, but I can only read audio. So
Oh.
I had to retire, of course, as a librarian because I couldn't do that job without being able to read print. And I needed quite a while to recover after that stroke. But it had been my goal from the very beginning. I actually published the book in print and as an ebook in 2017. And when it was published, those were the only options. I didn't the only way to do something in audio was to go through Amazon and use one of their readers. And I had a friend who did that. And the friend who did that discovered that the professional readers, the readers who were most skilled, would only read a book if it was a very well-known author, a bestseller, potential bestseller author. That what you were left with in terms of choices of readers were beginners, and some of them were good and some of them weren't, but there was a fair amount of doing auditions, listening to people read and deciding which ones suited you, tone of voice, whether they had an accent that sounded like you or your character or whatever. And then there was quite a charge for any human being to do narration. It is very time consuming. And my book, for example, when I look at the time on it, it's going to take at least 8 hours of reading. But it would take much more of that because they can only read for short amounts of time before they get tired of reading and make mistakes. And every time they make the mistake, they have to go back and retape. So the charge for an author to find someone who will, a human narrator for their book, can be quite large. And in addition to that, the friend that I knew who did this then had a lot of editing time because the person who was narrating the book would send out chapters that had been read, and then the author would say, "Well, no, that's not really the tone of voice I wanted there, or I wanted the emphasis on a different sentence," or you know, so there was quite a bit of editing that the author had to do and correcting until they got what they wanted. And I did not have either the money or the time and energy to do that at that time. So in 2017, that was the year I was diagnosed with liver cancer. And I knew that I was facing a liver transplant when that book was published. I wasn't able to do the same kind of book launches that most people did, but I certainly sent out a lot of information that I could to the people I knew and the people who I thought would be interested in the book. But physically doing a book launch was out of the question. I was waiting for a liver transplant. And then in the last year or two, I began to read about how AI technology was not only less expensive, it would require less time in editing. Of course, you don't have quite as much that you can control in terms of tone of voice and pronunciation and things like that. If you hear an error, there are some things you can correct, but some things that you really can't correct the way you want. And I can certainly hear that when I listen to my own audiobook now. I can say, "Oh, they didn't say that word correctly." You know, but it's a machine. It's not a human
Right.
being, and there's only so much you can control. But I did end up with a fairly inexpensive voice that you've just heard a few minutes ago. And which took me a minimum amount of time to go through the book and listen to each chapter and approve it or ask for some correction.
So, what company did you go through to get this
Well,
done? I'm assuming it must have been some kind of a company.
I'm not going to pitch the particular company, but I will tell you that
Oh, okay.
the company I used is now, I think, struggling because there's a lot of competition now. Only a couple of years
Right.
later, there are lots of different options for people, and I might not have even made the same choice if I made it again today. If I ever write another book, I might not go with the same company. Although I'm very grateful to them, but there are some wonderful companies out there. And right now, for example, you can go to some publishing companies like Apple, I know, has an option where they will give
Yes.
you a voice to read your book as long as you promise to sell it on Apple. So
Right.
I would say I'm just highly recommending this as something you should pursue on your own because it does change rapidly, the options that are out there. And
Well, I found the voice that read your excerpt amazing. I wouldn't have known it was AI if you hadn't said that, because it definitely had some human qualities. Like talking about when the doctor says, "You need to let me do my job or I'm going to have you removed." The way she said that, a robotic voice normally wouldn't do that. I just think I find that totally amazing. They're able, of course, it did say in your tagline she snarled, and that would give, but that would, but a robot, I'm surprised that would give a robot a clue to actually snarl it, but she sure did. I mean, that was just totally amazing.
I agree. I was impressed. And I would certainly, and now I am writing to a blog. I've been writing to blogs for a long time. Every time I do a blog piece, I do an audible reading of it from one of the other AI voices. And I've been experimenting with different AI voices. And you can pick voices who are young, you can pick voices who they call mature, you can pick female, you can pick male, you can do, all kinds of things. And you can even mix and match. You know, if you've written a novel and you have some narrators that you want a male voice for and some you want a female voice for, you can do that now.
That's great. That's good to know. Great.
And the other advantage, of course, is that it made it so easy for this to then be sent off to Perkins School and have it go on to Bard,
Oh,
which is,
great.
which my mother used talking books in the day and loved them.
Oh,
And
great.
that was part of my goal, was to make sure that this was available for people who needed to have books read. So, and that's, for people who have vision loss, or it also includes anybody like myself who has other reasons that they cannot read print.
Well, that's terrific. So, where can we find the book?
Well, right now there's actually a list of them on my website, and I'm going to refer you to that if you don't mind.
Okay, that's the graywoodpress.com that I
Yes.
mentioned earlier. Okay,
When you
all
go to
right.
graywoodpress.com, there is a section. The first section you will probably get is my blog. And
Okay.
but there is another section that says that it's about the book. So there's also a section there that says that it includes some of the reviews that my book has gotten. And there's a section there that tells more about me. But the one that you really want to go to is the one that says a memoir. And that will give you a whole list of where you can find it as a paperback book, as an ebook, and as an audiobook.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we've already given you your website. Did you want to give us any other contact information, or you think just the website is going to be
I think the
sufficient?
website will be fine because people
Okay.
can get me from there. They can.
Great. Great. All right. Well, that was all that I have. So I think we can go ahead and open the floor up. Annie, do we want to do raised hands? How many people do we have? Well, I'll leave that up to you since you're the hostess with the mostest.
Thank you. We have 16 people, so maybe we should raise hands. So if you want to raise your hand, it's Alt Y on a PC. It's Command Shift Y on a Mac. And if you're on an iPhone, you have to do it on you have to go to the bottom, the menu on the bottom, and look for the options button, right, Abby?
Right.
Yes,
Actually,
and
well,
tap on
it
that.
depends. It might be under more, or sometimes in some meetings I've even found a raised hand right there on the bottom of the screen in the
Yeah, me
right-hand
too.
corner.
Yes. Oh, we have our first
So,
raised hand. And if you're on a landline phone, it's a star nine. So here we go. The person with the phone number, 1415. You can unmute and ask your question.
I think it's 1445.
Oh, 1445. Sorry, I got a little.
Oh, hi, Annie. It's Sally Rosenthal.
Hi, Sally.
Linda, hi. I was a caregiver, the sole caregiver for my husband for many, many years. So, your story about being a woman with physical challenges and taking care of your parents really resonates. Looking back and, with hindsight and with what you know today, what advice would you give to other caregivers in our situations?
Well, I think you do the best you can, and then you forgive yourself for what you can't.
Good
And
advice.
that would be my best advice.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All righty. Keisha, you're next.
Hold the audio now.
Yes, hello. How long did it take you
Now lowered.
to write the book? And yeah.
Okay, this is a hard question because I've written all of my life in various ways, letters, and then I would make short stories, and I eventually began blogging and putting up pieces there. And it took me a while before I said to myself, "Oh, I have enough here for a book." So I often say it took me at least 10 years to compile the chapters of the book and then put them together in a logical format.
Great. Lisa.
Hi, I really enjoyed hearing about your life, and I also have been a caregiver before. My question is, how did you keep going? What do you think gave you the strength to just keep doing everything you had to do?
That's a great question. And my immediate reaction is the only thing that kept me going was love. And I think that love sustained me. Love made it important for me to continue. And it also gave me the support that I could not have done it without Robin's support and without that love.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. Dawn, you're next.
Am I unmuted?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, Linda. Thank you so much for being here tonight. And I'm definitely going to get the book. I had a question, if you don't mind, about your aphasia. So it affected your ability to read print. How has it, if it has, affected your ability to write? Have you had to find alternate tools for writing, or are you still able to use a keyboard and pen and paper? Or,
Yes. Yeah. Luckily, I did not affect my ability to use my fingers.
okay.
So I can use the keyboard and type. And then I do frequently have it read back to me because I can make typos. I can easily misspell something, although now, of course, spell check will correct things even if their spell check doesn't understand what I'm trying to say. But at least when I get use tech a speech function on my computer, do text to speech, I can make corrections as I go. So it does take me more time to
Right.
compose a piece, even a piece that's fairly short for, say, a blog piece,
Sure.
because I'm reading it back to myself using text to speech.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'll check out the website.
Okay.
Thanks.
So, Linda, this is Abby. I just thought of something. So, on your computer then, do you use speech then, like you read your emails and browse the web, or are you still able to do that with your eyesight, with your
I
eyes?
even use it on emails. My brain will handle a very short amount of text. If it's only a sentence, I can probably figure out what it says. But even three or four sentences, and my brain just doesn't want to translate
Oh,
what those
sure.
letters are.
Okay.
So
Okay.
most emails, I have the text read to me,
Okay, great,
and I do
great.
that on the websites. And thank goodness for technology.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
the other thing
Absolutely.
I was going to say about the AI, there's so much controversy over AI and is it going to put people out of work? And I had somebody who was really angry at me when I told her that I was using an AI reader. And I said, well, A, I can't afford any other kind. It's not like I'm taking a job away from somebody because I can't afford any other choice. If it wasn't for AI, I wouldn't have an audiobook. But technology, especially I think for those of us who have a disability, is just so critical. It has improved my life immensely. When I think, if this had happened to me even 20, 30 years before it did, I would not have the ability to have published that book.
Absolutely. All right, Annie, do we have any other hands?
No questions. Nope.
Okay. Well, and I really don't have any other questions. I'd like to thank Don for bringing that up. I hadn't even thought of that when you said you had the aphasia that made it hard to read. So I'm glad Don thought of that. So, well, if we don't have any other questions, there's Keisha's got a
Keisha?
hand up.
Go ahead, Keisha.
I'm sorry, could you give the website again in the code?
Yes, the website is Graywood Press, and that's all one word, Graywood, Wood, Press, Press dot com.
All the audio.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Well, all right then. See, hearing no more questions, I'm going to go ahead and turn the floor now over to Lisa, who will tell us talk about Behind Our Eyes for the benefit of those who have joined us who are not familiar with the group. So, Lisa, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. And I'm so glad that you are all here tonight. And it was a wonderful book launch. I'm very interested in your book, Linda. So Behind Our Eyes is an organization for people who are disabled. We have plenty of activities. We have a writer's exchange part of our group where other writers give classes for free to anyone interested in their subject. If you are new to the group, there is a pilot program in which people greet you and sort of tell you more about the group and answer your questions and all that kind of thing. We have produced three anthologies, and I know some people are hoping we will do a fourth one. And they are available to read. There is a reader's workshop where people have chances to read their work out loud and then just for practice, it helps with the flow of the piece to hear it out loud. And it also helps with people being comfortable to read if they can read it. We have a Magnets and Ladders magazine that comes out twice a year. And in fact, our fall issue is now being created with the deadline of August 15th for, any kind of prose, poetry, nonfiction, fiction, anything. There are guidelines and you can go to the website to see what those guidelines are. we have Write-In Fridays that Nell's organized, where we go and we talk about what we're going to work on, and then we spend an hour working on that thing, and we come back and we talk about how we've accomplished something. Of course, we have these book launches. We have programs twice a month on Sunday evenings that are different topics. We have our email list, which we can talk about or send writing out to people and they can comment on them. We have critique groups. Right now, we have quite a few of those. We're going to have a nominating committee this year because we are going to maybe have the same incumbents or new people for vice president, secretary, and two members at large. We have the genre group where we have different genre each month. This month it's mystery, and next month it'll be children's stories. We have a marketing group, and we have, of course, our just regular email list. And if you go to behindoureyes.org, there's a form called, it says Join Us, and you can fill out the form and then you will be contacted if you want to, join us. So I don't know if I missed anything. But if I did, someone can let me know.
Well, maybe I will just say if there's anyone here tonight who is an author with a disability and you're interested in joining our group, you can go to our website at behindoureyes.org and you'll find more information about us. You'll find a link to where you can read Magnets and Ladders, but then you'll also find a membership form that you can complete if you'd like to join us. So, all right, and that's basically all I have. Are there any more questions before we close for the evening?
Keisha's hand is still up. I don't
Oh,
know.
it probably didn't get lowered. Let me
No,
see.
it, yeah, no, I tried lowering it. It popped back up again. But let's just double check. Keisha, do you have any more questions?
All the audio.
No, that was all.
Oh,
Thanks.
thank you. Okay.
Okay. Well, those
And
things
hello.
happen. Oh, there we go. Now it went down. All right, so good. All right, well,
Thank you
thank you.
so much, Abby. I really
You are
appreciate
so
it.
well. Oh, Linda, did you want to have any closing thoughts? I'm sorry, I didn't
I
mean.
really want to thank you and also Behind Our Eyes for doing this. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. And thank you, Linda. Thank you all for coming this evening. And by the way, I don't think I introduced myself. I'm Abby Taylor, but I'm so glad that you could all join us this evening. And good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good
Abby
night.
Taylor has left the